Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Hello and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about A Treatise of Human Nature by David Hume. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Aaron Alexander Zubia, a professor of humanities in the Hamilton Center for Classical and Civic Education at the University of Florida. His brand new book, just out from the University of Notre Dame Press, is The Political Thought of David Hume, The Origins of Liberalism and the Modern Political Imagination. He joins us by Zoom as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Aaron, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Thank you, John. Great to be here.
Why is A Treatise of Human Nature by David Hume a great book?
Great question. And when I'm asked this question, you know, what makes a book great, I think about two things. First, is it excellent? And second, is it read? Is it influential? And I think A Treatise of Human Nature is a great book on both of these counts. First, it's excellent. In the treatise, Hume responds to the major intellectual currents of the day. He tests the radical skepticism of Pierre Bayle by ruthlessly questioning every theory, every idea, every proposition. He tests out John Locke's epistemology. He tries to determine what's out there in the external world. What is it that we can truly know, that we can truly access? In a similar way, he continues the modern effort of Descartes to find out as much certainty as possible in our investigations. And you can think of the treatise in this way, as an effort to take skeptical questioning as far as it can go. That's part of the drama of the treatise, right? Take skeptical questioning as far as it can go and try to recover from that. It leaves Hume at a dead end. He describes himself as shipwrecked and filled with philosophical melancholy and delirium, right? And so part of the drama of the treatise is trying to recover from that. So it's an excellent book for a dense philosophical work. There's some elegant prose and drama. And the second aspect was Hume's treatise read. And is it read? It wasn't read so much when it was published. It was published anonymously in 1739 and 1740. And Hume complained in his autobiography that it had fallen dead-born from the press. Yeah, he wanted a commercial success, and he didn't get it with the treatise. By the end of his life, his essays and his history of England, they had sold better than the treatise. They were more widely read than the treatise. Still, Hume's critics were trying to refute the ideas that he presented in his treatise. And Hume was getting so irritated by this that at the end of his life, he renounced the treatise as a juvenile, delinquent work because he wanted to direct his critics' attention to his other works, his more refined writings that he worked on editing and amending and revising for the rest of his life. Still, it's Hume's treatise that philosophers pay the most attention to. It's Hume's treatise that really established Hume's reputation in the long run. It really is the most systematic presentation of his philosophical system. And that's why the treatise is what's read most by college students today in their philosophy classes.
We will talk about all of that, what this book says, its huge influence, where it fits within the Scottish Enlightenment, the legacy of this work, but also David Hume in general, and a lot more. Aaron, let's jump in with the title of this book, or rather the subtitle. The title is A Treatise of Human Nature. And then on the title page of the book, we get a long subtitle, as you sometimes get in the 18th century. And the subtitle is this, quote, "Being an attempt to introduce the experimental method of reasoning into moral subjects." Now that, to me, sounds kind of scientific because of the word experimental. What's going on here?
Yeah, there is a social scientific sense to this. And you almost think, okay, well, are we, you know, does this foreshadow the behavioral sciences in 19th century or 20th century rather? Are we going to put human beings in laboratories and, you know, test them out there to come out with, you know, quantitative outcomes that, that teach us about human nature? That's not quite the sense that Hume is taking the experimental method here. What Hume is doing is he's looking at all the sciences. He says mathematics, natural philosophy, natural religion. He says all of these have their foundation in the science of man. And so Hume is articulating in this book a science of man that he says has its foundation in the only reliable foundation, which is experience and observation. And so Hume is thinking as a Newtonian here. He's trying to apply a Newtonian method to the study of human nature in order to find out, you know, what general universal principles will help us understand human nature, right? So he's looking for a foundation for the science of man that can then serve as a foundation for the rest of the sciences. And his experiments are not conducted in laboratories. He says in the introduction to the treatise, Hume says, I'm going to take human beings as they are in their daily life, conversations, pleasures, business, and he's going to glean up experiments in this way. So he's going to observe human life out in the open and derive conclusions, right? He's not going to get to the core principles. He doesn't think we can get to, you know, the essence of man, but he thinks that we can get to some certain general principles, universal principles that can apply in all cases. And that's what he's looking for.
So it sounds like he's a people watcher sitting in a cafe, looking at people and just, you know, obviously observing things in his own interactions with friends and strangers and so forth. Is that essentially what he's doing? And then give us an example of how he derives a universal principle of human nature from this.
He does, kind of sound like a creepy people watcher. And the strange thing is, he starts out in the first book of the treatise. It's organized into three books. The first book is Of the Understanding. The second is Of the Passions. And the third is Of Morals. But this first book, Of the Understanding, he's by himself. He's not watching anybody. He's engaging in introspection. This is part of what drives him crazy, makes him anxious. The first part of the treatise, the first book, he's trying to rationally justify his beliefs. Beliefs in the uniformity of nature, belief in personal identity, whether the self or the soul, belief in the continued existence of the external world. And then he finds, I cannot rationally justify any of this. And so this is what launches him into philosophical melancholy and delirium, leads him to be shipwrecked. And then he discovers that he needs to get out of his room, out of his space. He needs to have conversations. He needs to go to dinner parties. He needs to play some backgammon. He needs to take a walk. He needs to go out there into society once again. And it's really in books 2 and 3 of the Passions and of Morals that Hume will use, you know, more real world examples or historical examples and really get out there and explore the nature and the purpose of human society, the nature of the passions. So it is strange that he opens the book saying, I'm going to glean experiments from daily life. And the very first book, lengthy and dense as it is, he's in isolation.
Now, these are big, heady topics, and human nature, my gosh, there's no bigger topic than that, perhaps. But as he goes through this process and learns and tries to identify universal principles, give us a kind of takeaway point. Does he ever arrive at one?
Good question. He does. He finally finds something that he can trust, something that he can latch onto. And so all of all these things that I mentioned, I'll stick to causation. Now, you're right. This is really heady. I mean, the treatise is a dense book. You know, no wonder it wasn't a commercial success, because it takes a good amount of effort on the side of the reader to come to grips with some of the things that Hume is doing. Causation is one of the most controversial elements on which Hume speaks. He gives a controversial argument. He says that there are no causal powers in the external world, no necessary connections. and that all of our ideas about causation, they are formed in our own mind. Now, here's an example. All right, so billiard ball example is classic. So Hume says, imagine that one billiard ball is moving and it hits another and it causes that second one to move. And you see this movement repeated, say, five times. We're then led to expect that the second ball will move when we see the first ball moving and approaching it. And this leads to our idea, Hume says, of causation, right? The first ball moves, hits the second ball moves. Now, Hume says, this is something called Hume's fork. There are two types of reasoning. One is demonstrative reasoning, which deals with logical relations, the relations of ideas, mathematical truths. For example, 2 + 2 = 4, and it's not going to equal 5. Right? And we can't even imagine a world in which 2 + 2 = 5, it just doesn't work. So you can demonstrate that. But the laws of nature, matters of fact and existence, this is where probable reasoning comes into play. And we don't have all the facts because we don't, you know, we can only experiment so much with the laws of nature. We can only experience so much. And yet we can conceive of anything happening, right? The laws of nature, for all we know, might change. We haven't experienced every event. And Hume says everything we can conceive is possible. So we can conceive of the first ball moving and, for some reason, second ball not moving. We can't rationally demonstrate that nature will work the same way every single time. So this is part of Hume's critique of reason. He says, I can't demonstrate rationally that the future will be like the past. What I have is a feeling, right? A feeling that leads me to believe that the future will be like the past, that the second ball will move, that there's a constant conjunction, that two things go together. I can't rationally demonstrate it, but I feel it. This is what Hume ultimately relies on. Not reason, but that feeling, that custom, he calls it, or that habit, or that experience that nature gives us, right? Nature just instills in us the confidence that nature is uniform. Or else, you know, we couldn't operate. Hume says we must act and reason and believe. And the radical skeptic is at a loss because he's just thinking like, well, how do I know anything? You know, how do I know that cause and effect is going to operate the way I think it does? How do I know that the sun's going to rise? And Hume says, nature gives us the tools, which is custom, habit, and experience, to go on. And so, and Hume ends up being a moral sentimentalist, which means he thinks that morality itself, right, comes from feeling. So this is one of the big takeaways for Hume. You have the critique of reason, and then you have a reliance on custom, on habit, on feeling.
Does this ultimately then lead him to religious skepticism? Because that is his reputation, of course. And part of the controversy that surrounds David Hume is that he's a religious skeptic. Is that the right way to look at David Hume? Is that where this line of thought takes him?
Yes. So when Hume was read in his day, he was read as a radical skeptic, as an irreligious thinker. One of his nicknames was the Great Infidel, and he got tremendous pushback for this. And you know, in the treatise itself, you don't see many mentions, direct mentions of God. But the question of God is central. Hume knew it, and Hume's readers knew it, because one of the primary ways that 18th century Christian theists defended the existence of God was the cosmological argument for God's existence, which depended on something called the principle of sufficient reason. The principle of sufficient reason is that everything that comes to be has a cause or a sufficient reason for its existence in itself or something else. And so this was, you know, this link of cause and effect, right? Cause and effect is something out there in the world. There are necessary connections. And in order to explain things, we naturally resort to this kind of cause and effect thinking. So a leading theistic argument was that everything that comes to be must have a cause or a reason for its existence. The world came to be, and God is the cause of that existence. So Hume by saying, you know, anything that we can conceive is possible. So in that case, you know, maybe the world is eternal, or maybe the world didn't have a cause. And also Hume's reliance on experience. You know, nobody experienced creation. So what we have here is Hume, as a contemporary scholar says, burning all bridges between the world and God, right? So if we can't rely on demonstration based on the principle of sufficient reason, based on something out there in the world called, you know, causal power, then it shakes our confidence in the existence of God. And it's not only that, it's a couple other things I think are worth mentioning. In the very first paragraph of book one of the treatise, Hume says there are nothing but perceptions. That's how we think, with perceptions. And there are two types. One type of perception is impression. And there are impressions of sensation, right? Our sense experience and our emotions. So these are impressions. And then we have ideas. Ideas are copies of impressions. So if you hear Hume described as an empiricist, it's because of this. He thinks that all thought derives from sense experience. But if all our ideas derive from our impressions, and we don't have an impression of God, how can we have an idea of God? And so these are several of the ways that Hume is subtly and controversially, you know, severing the mind's access, you know, to the external world and to God. And just I'm going on a bit long here, but just one more thing on this question I think is relevant. Hume sided with the free thinkers on some matters. So, you know, I said that for Hume, right, the mind consists of perceptions. And he says, we often think of the self as something that receives these perceptions, right? Like there's an I underneath our thoughts and ideas and experiences. But Hume says, well, it seems to me that we don't have access to any underlying self or soul. It seems like we're just a bundle of perceptions, rapid perceptions, one after another, and we can't access anything underneath that. For all I know, that is what I am. And he says, you know, for all we know, it's just thought. It's just the movement of matter that produces thought. And here's another thing where the free thinkers, the materialists, were saying, well, there's no need to think about the soul as that which causes thought and exercises it force in the material world, right? And Hume says, well, it might as well. I mean, it might be thought that it's just matter in motion that produces thought. And so all these ways, right, Hume is siding with the free thinkers, undercutting our belief in the soul and in creation. I mean, so boom, you see this, and you can see why critics were up in arms about this. I mean, Christian critics and the majority of readers in Scotland and England were Christians.
So what does he say then about morality? As you mentioned, there are three books that make up a treatise of human nature. The third one is on morals. Given this was his view, a universe without God, possibly, what does he say about morals?
That is what people were interested in. Matter of fact, at the time of his death, the big question was, can Hume, the great infidel, who, by the way, was known as a pretty cheerful guy, would host dinner parties, liked to cook, told jokes, was friends with moderate ministers, not Orthodox ministers in the Scottish Kirk, but the moderates. He was on friendly terms with these folks. So he was known as a pretty good guy, but as he was on his deathbed and word spread, I mean, he was the most famous man of letters in the late 18th century, word spread about his death and people thought, Can an irreligious person, a radical skeptic and atheist, die a good death, right? Live a good life, die a good death. And James Boswell, who wrote the biography of Samuel Johnson, was friends with Hume, and he visited Hume on his deathbed to try to get the scoop. He was friends with Hume. He tried to get the scoop. How are you feeling as you approach death? And Hume gave him a speech. He said, well, I rejected the Calvinist religion in which I was raised when I was a boy, perhaps around the time of 11. He said that religion corrupted morals. And for Hume, he thinks, you know, his reliance on experience and observation, he was opposed to fanaticism and superstition. And he equated this with basically all forms of of religion. In some of his later writings, he said, true religion is essentially good morals. And he said, religious belief tends to corrupt good morals. Hume was an earthy guy. He wanted to keep things down to earth. As a matter of fact, one of the lessons of his skepticism was moderate, hold all views with doubt, and limit the sphere of investigation. So he said, don't even ask about that stuff, you know, that transcendence stuff, all that metaphysics, leave that to the side, because that's just going to make you fanatical, right? Just live life. There's sort of an Epicurean element here, right? There's live for what's pleasurable and useful. And Hume even said, he adopted the Epicurean view on his deathbed. He said, life after death will be no different than what it was before, right? Just nothingness. So he was tranquil. That's how he presented himself. And his friend Adam Smith, his close friend Adam Smith, he had several meetings with him, with Hume on his deathbed. Smith got in trouble for this. He wrote a sort of eulogy on Hume, and he said, Hume, more than anyone, more closely approached perfect virtue. And he was tranquil and he was in good spirits when he died. And there were many who didn't believe this. And it turns out that there was an alternative narrative shared by his housekeeper and spread by word of mouth across England and the continent, that actually Hume on his deathbed was tremulous, was terrified, would light a candle, wouldn't want it to be lit out, was just shaking, anxious. And it was suggested that, you know, one of the reasons he felt like this on his deathbed was that he had destroyed his mother's faith. And when his mother was dying, said, Hume, you've given me all these philosophical one-liners, and that's great, but I've lost all meaning and purpose. And so she had lost meaning and purpose with her loss of the Christian religion. You know, so it's still up for debate. Like, Hume wanted to testify to the possibility of morals without religion, that you could die well without faith in God. And, you know, the jury's still out. There are these two narratives out there, but that's what was on the line. And that's partly what was so controversial about Hume, is he writes this whole tome, you know, and many other writings saying that you can live a moral life without religion.
You mentioned Adam Smith, and he and David Hume together are maybe the two principal figures of what we call the Scottish Enlightenment. Aaron, very briefly, what was the Scottish Enlightenment, and how does David Hume fit into it?
Yeah, the Scottish Enlightenment occurred in the 18th and 19th centuries. Some of the main figures here are Francis Hutcheson, Hume and Smith, obviously, Adam Ferguson, William Robertson, and Thomas Reed. And I'd say that Hume was unique in that he was the most, well, perhaps, you know, the only irreligious figure in the Scottish Enlightenment, because the Scottish Enlightenment is distinguished from the French Enlightenment because the Scottish Enlightenment was more moderate. The French Enlightenment was more radical. I mean, even Hume wasn't radical enough for the French. A close friend of his said, you know, Hume, poor guy, he's too radical in England and not radical enough in France. But what another thing that distinguishes the Scottish Enlightenment is the focus on improvement. Hume and William Robertson, like Edward Gibbon, wrote philosophical histories that, you know, figures like John Adams really loved, where they explain the development of civilization. They were known for their works on economics. Hume and Smith together were at the forefront of the development of the science of economics. They were, by and large, supportive of the Glorious Revolution of 1688 and 89. That means they defended the established government of Great Britain, the limited monarchy. So they were broadly Lockean in their political theory. These are the essential elements of the Scottish Enlightenment.
You point out at the beginning of your new book, The Political Thought of David Hume, that Hume is the most influential philosopher, maybe of all time, according to academic philosophers. There's a survey about this. I was surprised to see that because I thought, gosh, the answer to that question, who's the most influential and important philosopher of all time, is, you know, Plato or Aristotle or something.
Right, right.
Yeah, explain that survey and why is it David Hume, and what does that mean for the modern world?
Hume was a likable guy. And in France, he was known as Le Bon David, the good David. And this survey asked, you know, which philosopher do you, you know, associate with most? Hume was the answer. And I think part of that is he was a great writer, a great stylist, popularizer of sorts, right? When the treatise didn't hit, he recast the books of the treatise. He wrote them in shorter, more digestible formats, wrote them for polite society. William Rose, editor of the Monthly Review, said, you know, Hume had an original turn of thought. He had originality of spirit. He was eloquent and refined. He was a man of the world. And, you know, I think this is what part of what is appealing about Hume. I mean, he didn't experience the wars of religion, but he read about them in writings by Hobbes and Pierre Bayle. And he wanted to just chill out, you know. He said, "Say it's all right, everybody. Let's enjoy ourselves, and let's not worry too much, you know, about these arcane metaphysical questions that put us at odds with one another." And so you can see how that might appeal, and that's sort of the Epicurean element of Hume. And matter of fact, Edward Gibbon called Hume that fattest of Epicurus's hogs. You know, Epicurus was an ancient Greek philosopher, and he said, you know, divine providence, you know, don't worry about the gods, that the world just operates as it does, you know, matter in motion, atoms flying around, tend your garden, do that which is pleasant and useful, and let's just chill out. And I think in our anxious age as well, we kind of want something that's easy. I mean, Hume described virtue not as the strict moralists did, not as the Stoics did, as something that requires diligent action, right? Austere effort. He said, no, virtue is filled with charms, and it wants you to relax and you know, and enjoy life. I mean, so this is appealing, I mean, to many people, I think.
David Hume was born in 1711, died in 1776. A lot has been thought and said about this guy across now nearly three centuries. You have a new book on him, The Political Thought of David Hume, The Origins of Liberalism and the Modern Political Imagination. What new thing did you want to say about this guy?
You're right. I mean, there's there's so much that has been written on him. The way I come at it is I take Hume's early critics seriously. I think sometimes they're dismissed as superficial readers of Hume. But many of the contemporary readers of Hume noticed that there wasn't only the skeptical element of Hume's writing, but also the Epicurean element. And my argument in the book is that, you know, this very approach, this sort of let's leave questions of God and the divinity and religion behind us, and let's focus on utility or mutual advantage, this can seem like a non-metaphysical move, sort of even a non-philosophical move, right? Like, leave philosophy to the side, and let's just focus on the here and now, and focus on, you know, common questions and political and economic life. And that's what we'll call the exercise of public reason and public political discourse, right? And my argument is there is a whole lot of philosophy. I mean, Hume, as much as anybody, was concerned with the truth. And I think to look at him as someone who puts philosophy to the side and just focuses on temporal life, that move comes with a lot of philosophical maneuvering, deep philosophical maneuvering. And when we think about politics today, and we think about public political deliberation today, if we think we can just think in terms of utility and agreeability, and that has nothing to do with philosophy, I mean, that's wrong, because Hume builds on ancient philosophical traditions and modern philosophical traditions, right? I mean, it's a skeptical, irreligious viewpoint. If we take natural law seriously, if we take Christian theology seriously, if we take that great tradition of Greece, Rome, and Jerusalem seriously, we're going to come to different conclusions when it comes to our thinking about morals and politics. So my book is about how Hume shaped the political imagination in a way that, you know, we thought, oh, we're doing without philosophy by focusing on the here and now. But really, no, there's a whole lot of philosophy there, and I'm trying to uncover that.
You say in the book also that both modern progressives and modern conservatives find at least some of their roots in David Hume. Where do conservatives see their roots?
Yeah, that's, I mean, there are certainly what we would call conservative elements in Hume. For example, in his later writing, in his essay, he says, in one of his essays of The Origin of Government, he says that there's a perpetual struggle in government between authority and liberty. And while civil liberty is the perfection of civil society, authority is necessary for the existence of liberty. And toward the end of his life, he got frustrated with extreme calls for liberty. And he defended authority in that sense. So there's something conservative about that. In Hume's History of England, he wrote about the English Revolution, the civil wars in the 17th century. And he argued that, you know, the application of ideology, trying to remake the world, you know, this will not end well. It will cause disorder and the rise of absolute power. And people on the French right during the French Revolution looked at this and said, yeah, that's right. It was used as a critique of the French Revolution. So these are certainly conservative elements in Hume. And, you know, I do want to mention in book three of the treatise, Hume has a narrative, a theoretical history of the development of society and government. And he says that justice is man-made, but it's based on commercial transaction, the desire to, as Smith would say, you know, a truck, barter, and trade. And Hume sees the role of government as the protection of the liberties that make economic exchange possible. So we see these conservative elements, and I don't deny that they are conservative elements. But in Hume, there's also this progressive sort of history of the development of society where he looks at everything before the modern world as backward. We can't really learn from it. So that includes a kind of traditional Christian theology, that includes a kind of feudal background of Christendom. So he's fully modern in that sense. So the type of conservative I think he is let's make some progress, but not so fast. Like, not too fast. Let's not risk order in the process. And that's the kind of conservatism I see in Hume.
How did you discover David Hume and then come to want to devote so much of your scholarship to him?
Hume's inescapable in the history of philosophy in the West, the history of ideas. Kant said, you know, Hume awakened him from his dogmatic slumber. Jeremy Bentham said the scales fell from his eyes when he read Hume's writings on utility. John Stuart Mill said the history of utilitarianism goes through Horace, Epicurus, Hume, and Bentham. And then, of course, I mentioned to you the way conservatives and liberal reformers have gained inspiration from Hume. And thinking about, I mean, if you're a fan of Aristotle, I actually like Aristotle quite a bit. The biggest critic, I think, and the most forceful critic is Hume. And if you're going to look at some of the greatest philosophers in the ancient world, if you're going to look at Aristotle and think of him as one of those figures, I certainly think of him as that. And you look at Hume, I mean, it's Aristotle and Hume presenting two different views of the world. And Hume is often presented as the foil to Aristotle. So I wanted to take Hume seriously. I wanted to figure him out. I mean, how is he a conservative? In what sense does he belong in the utilitarian tradition? Right. And so that's why my book focuses on the shaping of the modern political imagination, because Hume is right there in the center. And it seems like we're all drawing a little something from him. And he doesn't always give the right answers, but he always asks the right questions, which is why it's worthwhile to study him.
One final question. What's the case for reading him now? Particularly, should we read A Treatise of Human Nature, this longer book? Should we read the more popular version that he wrote of it later called An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding? That's actually what I had to read when I did political theory, a course on political theory as an undergraduate. I had to read that shorter version. What do you recommend? But is it important to read these original texts, or can we just read his inheritors and understand his philosophy that way?
I say go to the original texts. So that's right. If you want the gentler, more accessible, and refined Hume, you know, go to An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, published in 1748. That's the revised version of Book One of the treatise. Or read An Inquiry Concerning the Principles of Morals, which Hume said by far was his best book. That was published in 1751. And that's the revised version of Book Three of the treatise. But if you want the young, adventurous Hume I mean, he wrote the book, The Treatise of Human Nature, over a 10-year span from the time he was 18 to the time he was 28. So there's this youthful vigor that you find, and there's this drama in A Treatise. If anything, you know, I'd recommend the last part, part four of book one. You know, that's actually one that I would point you to, the conclusion to book one. If you really want to get a sense of Hume's treatise without tackling the whole thing, because that's a challenge. But go to that part four of book one, to the very end of it, to the conclusion of the book, and you'll get a sense of the young Hume and the dynamism that is there in his philosophy.
Aaron Alexander Zubia, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about A Treatise of Human Nature by David Hume.
Thanks so much, John.
You've just listened to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to the Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Please send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website, heymiller.com, on Twitter. My handle is @heymiller. And last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the Great Books Podcast.